Anybody today. We're going to be talking about the high cycle homestead or the high cycle approach today. And I don't know if anybody else has been throwing that term around. I'll tell you where the idea for today's episode came from. I am currently working on the biochar course for home food systems. And as I do that, I work through chapter by chapter by chapter. And biochar is one of the elements that you can bring into a homestead that really needs this approach. So I have a whole chapter, and it just so happened I was working on that chapter yesterday called the high cycle approach, meaning that instead of making biochar and throwing it in the garden, for instance, we make biochar, then maybe we put it in our pantry and we use it in a bin that we're storing something like onions or apples in. And that actually extends the storage life of the food. And then maybe it goes from there to the coop into the bedding. And then it performs a function in the bedding, and then it goes from the bedding into the compost, and then it goes from the compost into the garden. So it ends up in the same location, but it has to take a longer path through, and therefore it does more work. Now, I know some of you might be like, this sounds like function stacking. And it might be a little bit semantics to say there's a difference, because I don't know that there really is. But I can give you an example of a function stack that is not a higher cycle method. So that would be if we put in a pergola and we put food, some sort of food vining crop on it, and it grows up the pergola and it provides shade in the warm season, and then the leaves fall off and it lets sun in during the winter. That's clearly a function stack. It's not really taking the approach that we're taking today. And again, is it necessary to split them apart? I don't know that it is, because there's probably a way to tie that pergola and that, you know, perennial vining crop into something that works like this today. It's more about changing the way you think about it so you see more connections and more opportunities for function stacking than you otherwise would. What we're really talking about today is building resiliency through a multi-layered approach, right? Or a layered use path. In other words, we all are going to spend our entire lives and eventually lose the fight with something called entropy, right? Entropy is the decay of organization, the decay across time, and entropy always wins. In the end, entropy will defeat the entire planet because the sun will turn into a giant red ball of angry gas and eat the planet. We cannot defeat entropy. But what we can do is we can forestall entropy. We can make it take longer before it comes apart. We can build more resilience into a system. We can even ping pong energy. Here's an example of ping-ponging energy back to the top, to the high cycle of the system. And this was from a PDC that Jeff Lawton taught. And I'll give you the short version. He designed this system with multiple swales in it. And then these swales, of course, water gets spread out, little pocket ponds and all the way down the system. So this is a significant amount of elevation change over time. He gets down to the bottom of the property. At the bottom of the property, there's just enough room to pop a little pocket pond in before, you know, when you have rainfall over evaporation in your rainy season, eventually the water is going to put as much as it can into the landscape, and then it's going to go off property. It's going to go somewhere where you don't control it anymore. Well, down on that little flat, what Jeff did was put a little pocket pond in, and into that pond, he planted reeds. And so all that nutrient matriculated through that system, held on as much as it could, but there's still nutrient there. It goes in the pond, and it stays in the pond for a while, but even the pond eventually overflows and goes to a piece of property we simply do not have any control over. But the reeds being a very nutrient-hungry plant, suck up all that nutrient. So a couple times a year, you chop the reeds down, take them all the way to the top of the property and mulch the top of the property with them. Now we've rebounded that energy. We have once again, ping-ponged it back through the system. It is that type of thinking we're going to go in today. Here's a couple more examples. And sometimes it's, you know, what I'm going to be doing today, actually, and I think this would be cool. When I cover a segment, when we actually get started after we do our, you know, our sponsor segments and all, and I start going through things like chickens and deep bedding, gray water reuse, kitchen scraps, if you come up with something that could be added to that, put add on in all caps if you're in the live chat, and then give us your idea. It wouldn't hurt for you to say, like, add on gray water. Something like that, whatever you're talking about. And when we get to the end, instead of just doing Q&A, we'll go through back some of the ideas you came up with. Because I did not put every possible connection in here, and you would never use every possible connection. You would pick and choose based on what makes the most sense for your system. But here's an abbreviated example. How about the fact that I feed my ducks every day, and they eat a lot of the feed? But you know what ducks, chickens, geese do. They leave a whole bunch of crumbs in the bottom of the pan, right? So what do most people do with those crumbs? You just throw them out on the ground, and they go into the ground, and they provide some nutrient, maybe feed some worms. But we all know the, you know, kind of like, it's like the little kid that won't eat the sandwich unless you cut the crust off. You end up with this waste product. Well, that's fine, and I guess it does something. But what do I do is once a week, I have a bucket that I bring out when I go to feed my ducks, and I dump all the crumbs in the bucket, okay? And then that bucket sits on the table in my garage right next to my worm farm. And so when I'm adding coffee grinds and strawberry tops and everything else to the worm farm, handful of the dust from the duck feed goes in there. If I had a BSL, a black soldier fly, bin, that could go into there as well. Either way, I'm now feeding a second product, in this case worms. The worms have multiple outputs. So now we've put the waste product, the energy, it's a very energy intensive waste product too. It's crumbs from high protein poultry feed. Now we're feeding it basically to microbes who then feed the worms, and the worms produce an output from it, which is worm compost, which can be used in the garden, worm tea that can be used to fertigate, and it also is producing, of course, worms, which can be used for bait. I can sell them. I can use them to feed my fish, and I can feed my ducks and my chickens. Trust me, they really like it when you give them some worms. But I also now can take those worms and use them after the primary part of my compost, my large composting systems done in my bioreactors, and now I can take a handful of worms and drop them into that to let them help finish off that compost. You see how that all works together? And then eventually, those crumbs end up in my garden in the form of a compost product, one way or another, where instead of just going straight to the ground, they went through the system that way. Big difference there. Another one would be gray water for irrigation. You know, you can have gray water and it just seeps out through your trees, but you can have gray water that goes through something like a wicking reed bed type system that produces both food, and it also would produce a mulch product or a compost additive that would then seep out once that's exceeded into some sort of, let's say, a small perennial like zone 2 food forest, go into the ground. And that way the nutrient and the liquid is doing multiple things along the way. All we're doing is just holding the energy higher in the system for longer. That's the high cycle approach. At least that's what I call it. Again, I don't know if somebody else calls it that too, or somebody else uses a different name for it, or it just falls under function stacking. But as I was building the biochar course, that was the term that came to me, and that's what I'm going to be teaching going forward. Or grease, fat, and bone reuse. And we're actually covering that one, so I won't say much about it. But just as a, you know, beginning intro overview, when we have leftover product from, you know, chicken bones or beef bones or pork bones, you make bone stock. But if you, while you're making bone stock, you're also rendering fat. If we skim that fat, now that fat gets used in other cooking. And then once those bones have just had all the goodness we can possibly get out of them extracted into a stock, now we can feed those bones to the dogs because they're literally going to go soft and be easy to consume. Then the dog is going to manure the ground, and that nutrient is now being added to the property. Or we could dry the bones and char them into bone char. So again, what we're doing is we're just taking an element that most people would dispose of, and we're holding it in our own personal system longer. So that's where we're coming from today. And again, I would love it if you guys have any ideas, maybe idea or thought or something in all caps, and then whatever segment we're in when that happens, gray water, kitchen scraps, et cetera, and your idea. And we can hit those at the end. I am starring questions as well. I'm not going to answer it now, but if you see Dryware F Value Word question in all caps, that's how to do that. Again, this is for people in the live stream. You're listening to the audio. How do I do this? You don't. You'd have to be on a live stream to do this, and that's fun. It's usually around noon Central Time, but you can always find out the next live stream at tspclive.com. Get on the Telegram list or other social media. You'll always get an announcement from me as well. All right, so before we dig into all this, let's go ahead and hear from our sponsors of the day. Sponsor of the day number one today is Anton's Land of Biltong. I really recommend you check this guy out, man. His product is amazing. I actually receive payment from him as a sponsor in barter. I receive Biltong and Drewers and Cablanazi and all these other great things that he makes in the mail from him, right? Just like you can, except I take it in return for his sponsorship because it's just that good. I also got to hang out again with Anton this weekend up at the Crunchy Mama Farms Beef Processing Workshop. He was very generous, man. He came up there. He gave all the students some biltong and seasoning and taught all the students how to make biltong out of the beef that they were processing. Before we go to our next sponsor, let me just say real quick, obviously the Crunchy Mama Farms Beef Processing Be the Butcher workshop that I was part of is over. That's happened for the year. They do others of those. They do chicken processing workshops and they do pork processing workshops. Again, the company's called Crunchy Mama Farms. If you can, you need to get to one of these workshops. It was one of the best experiences I have ever had. I knew it was going to be good, but it was amazing to have that many people from that many diverse backgrounds coming together, working together, and processing beef from standing in the field to going in the cooler at the end of the day. And I'm going to tell you, it was a hell of a value. If you know what the cost of grass-fed beef is, really high-end grass-fed beef, and in this case, one of the cattle that we processed was a huge Wagyu Angus cross bull, and man, that was good. You probably leave with almost the value in beef that the whole cost of the whole thing was. Plus, awesome meals. He had great chefs, etc. And another little thing, Chef Ken was there, and he made some beef tartare. I had this piece that was trimmed off out of the skirt coming off of the strip loin primal, and I'm like, I just can't turn this into burger. And so I trimmed it up a bit, handed it to Ken. He made some steak tartare with it, with chicken egg yolk and some shallots and some other stuff. And I just decided I need more tartare in my life. I really do. And I think if you give it a shot, you might feel the same way. So definitely check out, all of that. Next up for our sponsor of the day is Above Phone. I'm actually going to have the owner of Above Phone on the show either next week or the following week, I don't remember, to talk more about what Above Phone does and how awesome it is to replace big tech with your own private ecosystem. You can learn more at abovephone.com. And remember, if you're an MSB member, you get $75 off any phone at abovephone.com. And if you're like, this newfangled private ecosystem phone, I'm not going to be able to use it. Yes, you are. They will provide you an expert that will walk you through the switchover process to using your Above Phone. Check it out today, abovephone.com. All right, with that, let's go ahead and dig into this again. If you have a question, the word question in all caps is the way to go. And if you have a thought or an idea for any of these systems as I go through them, put the word idea in all caps and then the segment. So, again, we're going to start off here with chickens and deep bedding. Just chickens, right? Something that helps me connect back to what you're talking about. So, again, we're talking about this high cycle approach, which is maybe another way of describing function stacking, but a different way of thinking about it to come up with the connections. How long can I keep this energy in my system and how far up in the cycle can I begin with it to do that? Again, I came up with this terminology developing the biochar course And the thing about biochar is you literally could, it's not a best practice because it's going to pull in nutrient and moisture and things like that if it's not already charged up. But you absolutely can make biochar, throw it on the ground. It can be that simple. And it's, unless there's an erosion problem that's going to take it off the surface, it's not going anywhere. It's going to be there for 1,000+ years. So it's not even really in of itself fighting entropy from keeping it from leaving the property. If biochar is leaving your property, topsoil is leaving your property, and in a big way. But can we make it do more through the process over a longer period of time? So the one element does more things and, more importantly, more work for us. If you back off that, the just straight up function stacking a little bit, and you start thinking about how far can I ping pong this up? Think of like when you were a kid, if you're older like me, and you stayed home from school because you were sick, and you watched that show, right? Remember, spay and neuter your pets, Bob Barker, The Price is Right. And they had a game in it called Plinko. And you went way up to the top and you let go of your little disc and it went down and you won a prize, right? If you're playing Plinko, you probably actually would like to start lower because you have more control of where you end up. But think about it that way. Like, you want to go as high as you can. And at any point in the Plinko game, can you, you know, pinball it back to the top and make it come back down again? It'll change the way you think about the elements on your property and you'll find new connections. So let's start off with chickens and deep bedding. So most of you guys out there, if you live somewhere, you can probably keep chickens unless you just don't want to, right? Like, it's a very, probably the most popular thing for homesteaders that start out with livestock is chickens. So what, you know, kind of the Mr. Bungle's method of keeping the chickens would be is you put, you know, some litter in your coop, and when it starts to stink, you take the litter out and you dispose of it some way. That would be as bad as it could possibly get. You're doing more work than you need to. You're doing more work as often as possible, and you're not getting much out of it. Or you pile it up to let it rot down, but you don't store it somewhere to do a proper compost. So a lot of that material ends up off-gassing, and you don't get much out of it, and your compost yield is lower, right? Those would be bad ways to do this. But if we use a deep manure method, where every time there's like it starts to smell a little bit, we just add more carbon. And we keep doing that maybe once a year or twice a year or three times a year, whatever works for you in your system. Then we bring that out material in mass. And now it is completely soaked with waste product, chicken crap, chicken pee, right? And so it's carbon rich and nitrogen charged at the same time. The only thing keeping it from breaking down is dry. So now we can then have compost from that waste, and we have enough material at one time so that we have held the waste and the carbon in the system longer before we composted it. But then when that composting is complete, what do we do with it? Do we, you know, put it on a trebuchet and shoot it at the neighbor's house? No, it's too valuable. We're going to go ahead and use it to grow food. And once it starts growing food, some portion of that food is for us, and some portion is probably, whether it's waste or specifically grown for, the chickens. So it goes that now we have a circle. Some portion of that entropy that we were going to lose that was going to go out our butts and down the toilet, more on that in a bit, ends up going back to the chicken. Or, you know, it could be in a worm system that goes to the chickens eventually. But in this case, we'll just keep it simple. That food then goes and scraps go to the chickens, who then poop out waste into the carbon-rich material in the next cycle. And now we have this loop, and it's an eternal loop, and all it does is continuously make the property better, increase yields, feed more chickens to make more waste, to make more fertilizer, to make more food. This is a high cycle approach versus a low linear approach where it just flows through and out and gone. That's what we're talking about today. Gray water reuse. So I did mention this one in the intro, but gray water, for those that aren't familiar with it, is everything except what your toilet sends out of your house. So your washing machine, your dishes, your shower, right? Anything goes down the drain but doesn't get flushed. That's gray water, meaning that it's a waste product, but it's less waste, you know, less to deal with, let's say. Now, if you're doing this, you want to use the right soaps and things like that so that they're biodegradable. But what a lot of people, again, would do with a gray water system is you tie everything except the sewer into a discharge pipe, and that might go into a swale in a food forest. That's great, and it's better than just dumping it into a ditch and down the road, obviously. But what if we take that water and we move it through a wicking bed type system or a reed bed type system? And now that system is going to slowly flow. Now there's a fill up, right? And there's a point where even a well-run system, there's going to be a surplus of water. Maybe you have some friends over and they take some extra showers, and then you get into the wet season and there's more water. So now every time you're taking a shower, you have water coming into your network of wicking beds, but it's pushing water out the other side. Now that water spills over. Now we can spill it over into, let's say, a zone 2 food forest, right? A small food forest, berries, small fruit trees and things like that. But at the same time, that wicking bed, right, we're going to grow some material in there that's more of a mulch material, and it's going to pull up that nutrient. We can then cut that mulch, and we can mulch those trees or our gardens with it as well. We could also be growing in there something that is a really fast-growing, high-volume thing that maybe ducks or chickens would like to eat as well, and then we can cycle through them. So now we're, again, extending how long it takes for that gray water to leave our property. Where, what does the average person do? They turn it on, the water goes the same place the poop and pee does. It goes down a sewer tank, and it either goes to a septic or it goes back to the city, and it's the city or the county or the state's responsibility to recycle the water. All we're doing here, we're pulling it back in. Why am I going to pay? Especially think about this. If you're paying for your water, you're not on a well. You know, pay for your water and send 90% of the water that you paid for down the sewer, because that's what most people do. It's just a different approach. Another way to look at this is with kitchen scraps to animal feed. So a lot of people might, you know, take your kitchen scraps and give them to your chickens. Okay, that's great. But can we think about it this a little bit of a more sophisticated way? So now we take our scraps from our kitchen and we feed them to worms, or if we have some scraps that really can't go to worms, or we just are doing something a little bit different, maybe scraps go to black soldier fly bins. Well, now those critters are going to eat that scrap, and they're going to produce the compost if we just had thrown it in the compost pit. But now we've added an element in the cycles, right? We're higher in the cycle, and as we come down lower and lower, we have more and more outputs over time. So now we have these, let's say we're doing black soldier flies, right? Now we can feed those to the chickens. Now, why not just feed the scraps to the chickens? Doesn't it accomplish the same thing? Well, no. So we've taken like most of your chicken scrap or your kitchen scraps, they're going to be low protein and low fat. Now we're converting things like potatoes. Maybe we're converting even inputs that we're bringing in from offsite. Like we talk to somebody at a coffee shop and they give us a big giant bag of coffee grinds that we can feed our soldier flies every week. Now we're going to bring that in into that system that we've created, and we're producing extremely high protein and high fat food in the BSL larva that can now be fed to fish or be fed to birds. So we're feeding a higher nutrient product to our egg-laying animal, let's say, or into our fish system for fish that we're later going to harvest as meat. Would you rather have compost or fresh fish? Catfish, fried catfish, right? Well, probably you'd rather have the fish. What if you could have both? Because we still have the off product from the BSL bin. Now, if we really want to take this up a notch, you can take the BSL frost, which is maggot shit, and we can put that into our garden, no problem. But we can take the BSL larva frost and give it to the worms and process it a second time. Now it's higher quality. It's also feeding the worms and the worm microbes. And now we have another product in worms and worm castings. The worm castings fill the role of the compost. You see how that works. Now we're ping-ponging the energy. We're not really doing a lot more work, though, are we? That's the key, is when you look at this, you want to find ways to take your existing systems, move the energy higher up in them, and not do a significant amount more work. It's not a lot of work to take the frost out of the black soldier fly bin and put it in the worm bin. You were going to do one or the other anyway, so all you've added is one small step to get a lot more energy out of the system in the end. Next up, we then can use that final product in the garden. So now we've got the black soldier fly frost went to the worms. Black soldier fly larva fed the fish or the chickens. Worms, some of those feed the fish or the chickens. Plus, we now have the worm castings that we can use in the garden. Or we can take the worm castings and inoculate the large compost pile so that we're adding another element into that large compost system, which we're doing anyway already. Again, it is function stacking, but we're coming to figure out this by thinking differently. How far can I push it up into the system? Let's look at a simple one, right? You might not think there's much to add to it. Rainwater harvesting, right? You catch water in the tank. Well, that's great. So we could use that water straight for irrigation, right? But what have we already built in this imaginary perfect homestead? Now, it's a good time to pause for a second. No one's going to do all of this, including me. I don't have a gray water system. And the way that my ground is and the way my house is built and the time frame it was built in, doing gray water here would be really, really difficult. Actually, we do have a little gray water system with the outdoor kitchen. That was easy. That was a layup. But, you know, the main house, like doing gray water here would be difficult. So we're not going to do everything. You pick and choose what works for you. But let's say this rainwater system, and we have a gray water system working as well. Well, now we can rainwater harvest. We could take the captured rainwater and we can use it for bathing. We can use it for drinking. We can use it for cooking. You know, maybe we need to filter it for that, but we certainly can do that. And then after that, it can go into the gray water system to be used for irrigation. So now that water's been in the system longer. We've used it to brush our teeth and cook our food, and it's still irrigating our crops. Maybe some of it has to go straight to irrigation, because we need some of that, but some portion of it can rebound further through the system. And the water gets cycled through multiple uses before it returns to the soil. If we weren't capturing the rainwater, it would land on the ground and soak in the ground. It still ends up there. We're just taking longer to get there by starting higher in the cycle. Really simple to understand, but very, very powerful. How about dairy animals, right? So we have a dairy, let's say we have some goats because we're a small homestead. So we have a few female goats that are on milk at any given time. We milk them on a daily basis, and now we have milk and we drink milk. Yay, okay, we won. Well, what can we do to keep that in the system longer? Well, of course, milk is initially used by humans, but excess or some of the cream skim might actually, if we have more than we can use, be fed to animals. Pigs love milk. Chickens love curd, right? So there's a lot that we could do with it. And it's actually a really high value food for them, and it helps them grow really fast. Like clabber for pigs is an old school homestead thing where, you know, the homesteaders had a cow or two, a dairy cow, that had way more milk than most families can use. So whatever they couldn't sell got made into clabber and fed to the pigs and fattens pigs up really, really well. And again, they love it. But what if we're also making things like cheese and yogurt, et cetera? Okay, so we make the cheese or we make the yogurt, but we're going to end up with some whey, right? And the whey is full of lactoacid bacteria, right? Lab. Okay, so now we could take the lab and we use it to fertilize plants. Or we use it to inoculate compost, especially after the thermophilic cycle, and increase the lactobacillus in the compost, or we can use it in aquatic systems, right? It's great for the health of aquatic systems. Adding lab to your aquatic systems, especially if you're in high intensity situations like aquaponics and you're using fish like bluegill that kind of nip at each other's fins and stuff, and they get little infections and fungus and wounds, the lab will clear that right up. So now we're having another use for a byproduct. It stops being a byproduct. It starts to become something you want. So we call that a co-product. And that's all because we're thinking of this higher cycle system, and don't let it go. Go up as high as you can. And as it comes down, at each point that you see a waste product, follow that permaculture principle, right? Produce no waste. What can this do? How many things can this do before I stop playing with it? Is another way to look at it. And then when we are using dairy animals, they produce poop, right? So now we have dairy waste. Well, we could just take that and compost it. Or since we're like making cheese and we need a source of heat, and we're talking about food here, and we're using cream that we may do a reduction with for a sauce, we need heat. Yeah. Okay. So we take the manure and we put it into a biogas system. We plumb the biogas system back into the stove. So we took the stove, we used the stove to heat up the milk to the right temperature to make cheese out of it, and got lab out of it. But the animal that made the dairy product for us pooped in the thing, and we threw the poop in basically a big bladder, and then that turned into biogas, and the biogas is used to cook the food. And at the end of the day, when we make biogas out of the manure, we still end up with a final product that's still compost, and it's still usable as fertilizer, which grows more food that feeds the dairy animal. That you see what I'm saying here? And there is no 100% retention of all that energy. That energy, entropy wins in the end, right? Entropy will destroy the planet in the end. A giant red ball sun will be so big, the sun will be bigger than the orbit of the Earth. It will burn it to a crisp. It's like 4 billion years is the estimate. Who knows, right? But for a time, how much can we do with it? So we will lose the energy in that system, slowly dissipated over time. But how long can we hold on to it? That's the way to keep thinking about this. Since we're talking about animals and feeding animals, let's move on to Nick Ferguson's favorite topic, right? Silvopasture, fodder trees, things like that. So now we're going to grow trees in this system. Let's say we're going to grow trees like mulberry or moringa or something like that, or hybrid poplar or hybrid willow, any type of tree like that. So now we're going to have to go in and pollard or coppice the trees, because if we don't do that, we don't have fodder for the animals to eat. Maybe it's the goats that are making the milk and the cheese that were used in the last system, okay? So we've done that, but as we cut that, we are not going to have 100% of what we cut be something the animal wants to eat. You know, they'll eat twigs maybe to the size of your little finger or a bit smaller than that, the green stems and stuff like that. But as we're cutting these trees, we're going to have, you know, some stuff that's like wrist thick or thumb thick that no animal's really going to want to eat. So we're going to use that for mulch, firewood, biochar, all three. A good fodder system, if you have something like a rocket mass heater to make Paul Wheaton happy, just that system alone, all the cutoffs that are not being fed to the animals as tree hay or fodder, right, can actually heat your house. And you can get enough out of a small fodder system with a rocket mass heating home to do that, or using something like just simply a simple rocket stove to do most of your cooking with. Or you can take that and go and make biochar. And then biochar is a whole other group of cycles that we're pinging back into. And we're going to finish with that one because I think it's the most powerful. The trees are going to regrow. That's the whole point. When we take a system like this and we prune and make fodder, or if we're just pruning things like persimmon and what have you, and we're doing more of a fruit or nut system, we're still going to prune and everything still grows back. That's the way these systems are designed. Additionally, the animals can be grazed in the shade under the trees. All we have to do is pollard them high enough that they can't browse on them. So we can have sheep, let's say, in a fodder-based system, but they're also grazing the fodder trees. We space them far enough. We let light through. We grow good pasture. The animals have access to shade. We can even then use those trees to create paddock-based systems. We can pop in some insulators and run some hot wire there and easily move. And we can basically grow fence posts in the trees that are actually shade for the animals and food for the animals and food for people and fuel wood and biochar material. Pretty cool. And we could even be doing some fodder trees that are also people food. So we could be doing mulberry and getting mulberries. We're not cutting all the trees all the time. So some of the system might have fairly high mulberry yields. Well, the mulberries then can be used for humans, but they also fall to the ground and can be consumed by your animals, especially chickens. Chickens love mulberries, and so do ducks. Just know that if you let them somewhere to poop after they eat them, they make black purple poop that you will not enjoy dealing with. But look at how much we can do just from something simple like fodder trees. And again, it is function stacking, but it's also that high cycle thought process. It's not as simple as a pergola and shade over something, right? It's energy rebounded multiple times. And then we can take the compost that comes out of that production, and some of that compost can go right back into the fodder system to grow more fodder for the animals who are manuring the system while they're in it anyway. Cool, isn't it? Okay. How about humanure systems? So what most people think is I'm going to take humanure system is basically have a composting toilet. I put the compost out. And there's, you know, it's not the most fun topic, and there's only so much we can do. But we could, instead of just using it in the garden, we compost our toilet waste with our carbon materials that are coming from, let's say, the fodder system anyway. So maybe we need a certain amount of wood chips or sawdust or what have you. So we take some of the material that comes out of the fodder system, the bigger material, throw that through a wood chipper. That's your carbon for your humanure system, right? Now we've got something else for that material to do. And then we're going to take that compost, once it's properly aged, it can go right back into that tree growing system. It's now a loop. It's now a loop. Now we've retained more of the energy by thinking about how to tie it back into where it's best used. Because humanure can be used in the garden, but it's probably a better practice to use it on perennials and things like that as well, just as another safety gap. And with what we're doing here, we got all the compost and fertilizer we need. We're never going to have to buy fertilizer in a bag again. Maybe some mineral supplementation here and there fed through the animals. Again, right? There's a bonus for you. So we can either put minerals that we know are deficient in our system straight on the soil, or we can feed free choice minerals to our animals. Much of that mineral will pass through the animal and one way or another end up in the system and be more bioavailable as well because it was a natural cycle into the system. Again, everything has a cycle. Molybdenum has a cycle, right? Calcium has a cycle, magnesium has a cycle. And by actually creating these cycles, we're going to end up a lot better off than just kind of throwing things on the ground and seeing what sticks, right? But then what we're doing is turning human waste into long-term fertility to grow food. We're growing food for humans. Again, we've created a loop cycle. If you think about the way we manage waste, and again, I'll admit I don't have a system like that on my property either. It's probably something I should do. I got to sell my wife on it to get it done if we're ever going to do that. But if we actually designed housing with this in mind, this could be done in a way that it wouldn't put people off as much, let's just say. And when you think about the way we handle this now, it's kind of stupid, right? So you have, let's think of your average gardener that's not all organic and not making compost and whatever, and they just put a garden in. We won't even go to farmers or what have you yet. And they have a few fruit trees and things like that. So they grow that stuff, and then they go to the store and they buy all of the inputs to keep it growing. And then they eat it, and they poop in the toilet, and they flush the toilet. The toilet goes down in the ground, and thousands of miles, maybe, that poop goes on a journey before it ends up, what's left of it, in some sort of plant, and it gets processed, and then it ends up in the ocean sooner or later. Everything eventually leads to the ocean. And so we've taken all of this high value nutrient. I know it's not something we want to, hold in our hand or anything, but it's an incredibly highly valuable resource that we're paying someone to take away. Think about it that way. Like everything that you put off your property, one way or another, there's a cost associated with leaving your property. There's a bill for sewer, right? And you're paying someone to take away a resource. When you take a shower, and instead of that water then doing second work and watering a wicking bed and doing third work and then watering some trees, you paid for the water and then you paid the sewer people to take it away. Isn't that nice, right? Next up, let's talk about one of my favorite subjects, ducks. We put ducks into a food forest. So now the duck is actually going to get a lot more food, so I have to feed it less. But it's also going to control pests in that food forest, and it's going to poop. Trust me, ducks poop all the time. I think they poop more than they eat. I don't know how they do that, how they battle that entropy, but it sure seems that way. So that's fertilizing the soil. But in, let's say, a small food forest, we're going to have fruit, and some of that fruit is going to not be the best. It's not going to get picked. It's going to fall on the ground. The ducks will then eat it, and they'll also eat any of the insects and other critters that go after that fruit. And trust me, that's a lot. When fruit starts to rot, everything wants to eat it. Everything in the ground, all types of micro and macro arthropods and insects and other things like that want to eat that fruit. And the ducks are predators. I am convinced, the Honey, I Shrunk the Kids movie, if you shrunk a human being down to about 3 inches and that human had to run through a flock of ducks, it would never survive. It would eat you. It would eat you like a T-Rex in Jurassic Park, right down whole. I've seen ducks eat young, like little mice, like the whole mouse, just up, tail, right down, gone. I've seen chickens tear them apart. Ducks friggin' swallow them like a snake. So that duck wants to predate. That's its goal in life. It is more a predator than like a grazer. Geese love to graze. Ducks do graze. But ducks, above all things, want to kill, murder, and consume things. All you have to do is watch a flock of ducks in the summer once the grasshoppers come out. It's a massive slaughter. So that intrinsic characteristic of wanting to be a predator plus being an omnivore will work for you in that system. All we have to do is tie the ducks and the food forest, in this case, together. And then what do the ducks provide? Eggs and meat. So this whole system, again, is back into that loop, that high cycle approach. And then that can be integrated into swales and wet zones. So now we can take the food forest, some micro swales, maybe we have a small pond, and maybe we even exclude the ducks from direct access to the pond because it's too small, and even a small flock of, let's say, a dozen ducks will over-nutrient the pond. But if the pond is receiving the trickle-through duck nutrient, now we can use the pond water as a source of fertility, maybe doing a form of aquaponics, or in this case, duck ponics. We could also be growing fish in the pond that can handle the level of nutrient like catfish. And if we want to, let's just say for whatever reason in our head we think we need to, because there's plenty of filtration in a biological system like that, I want to harvest the catfish when there's not duck nutrient going directly into the pond. I can simply move the ducks feeding during the time I want to harvest the catfish. Maybe I even drain the pond at that point. Then I can mass harvest the catfish and put them in the freezer. And at the same time, I can take all of the residue that's built up in the pond, or a significant amount of the silt down in the bottom of the pond. That's going to be anaerobic, which we don't really want to use it yet, but we can spread it out and let it become aerobic. And then that can be used as fertility right back up in the food forest. So all the runoff that came out of the food forest into the little pond was actually captured. And the system was designed from the beginning with the mindset of ping pong that energy. However, we could also do the Jeff Lawton trick and grow some sort of reeds at the edge of that pond, which is another way to capture energy and rebound it into the system. High cycle approach. High cycle approach, just over and over and over again. How many ways can you do this, right? Because the fish are producing waste as well. The fish could be being fed with the black soldier fly from the earlier system. You see how this all begins to link together. And you start to realize, like, we literally as human beings can engineer systems that are incredibly resilient and incredibly regenerative, but we don't. We take the fast approach. And if you really look at it, all our problems come from a short time preference. If you had a long time preference, you would sit and look at all this resource and say, I can't afford to let this go. If you have a short time preference, you think, I don't want to deal with it. I want somebody else to deal with my problem for me, and I'll pay them to take care of it for me, because that's what you're doing, whether you realize it or not. How about grease, fat, and bone reuse, right? Like, so I know most of you guys are doing some portion of every one of these things already. All right. So don't think I'm talking down to you when I say this, but the average person, let's say they go to the store and they buy a couple packages of chicken thighs. So now you're going to end up, by the time you're done using all those thighs, with a pretty significant amount of chicken thigh bone. You're also going to have the skin. Not everybody eats the skin, the cartilage and things like that. Okay. So the way we would approach that is we will take the thigh and use it however we want to. Sometimes it's cooked skin on, sometimes it's cooked skin off. But when we are going to use it skinless for whatever reason, that skin, then we take that skin and we render it down. We have another food product because crispy chicken skin is delicious. We never throw that away. But we have a byproduct from that, fat, chicken schmaltz. That goes in a jar. We use it to cook other food. So it gets used a second time in the mix. But it's not just that. So now we have the bones, and a lot of times there's fat and other pieces of skin and things like that on bones, especially like not just chicken here, maybe beef or pork. You often had a lot of fat. So as we simmer those bones to make a stock, all the fat will float to the top of the stock. We can skim that off and we have another source of fat for cooking other things. And as we do that, then we also could be using fat from various animal product like that, not just for cooking. We could be using it for soap or for skincare, depending on the type of fat that it is. So there's another use for it that puts it back in, and there's going to be some trickle down, some other resource, some other opportunity for rebounding it back higher into the system. But after we've made the stock out of the bones, if we don't have puppies to feed them to, or they're bigger bones than we want to feed to our pups, we could actually char the bones and add another char element to our soil-based systems, or we can use the bone char to make something like a deer repellent, because there's a way to make a bone sauce deer repellent that does a really good job of keeping deer, especially from killing young trees by chewing through the bark into the cambium and killing the trees, which deer will often do in the winter when resources are really scarce. Putting that bone sauce on those young trees will prevent that. So there's many different ways to make these systems very resilient and work well for us. How about mushroom cultivation? Mushroom cultivation is kind of one of those ultimate things for recycling waste. We grow mushrooms on mostly waste products. Now, I've seen people grow it on things like deer corn and wheat or rye, and you can do that, but you're still creating a waste product in the end. But most people are going to be doing, especially at home, on things like straw, sawdust, and coffee grounds, things that would normally go into a compost system. But now, instead of just composting that waste, we're going to grow a food product with it first, and we're going to increase fungal activity on our homestead. And fungal activity is the bomb for your gardens and for your small food forests and orchards and things like that, right? And then we're going to harvest, let's say, if you're growing something like oyster mushrooms, this is probably one of the best mushrooms for people to start out with. I don't know if you know this, but the stem of an oyster mushroom is literally full of oyster mushroom mycelium. You have to use some sterilization to make sure that you're not contaminating things. But basically, you can take an oyster mushroom stem, you can cut it open, and you can pull mycelium right out of it and then start the whole process over again, meaning you could grow, you know, several varieties of oyster mushrooms forever without getting into the point where you're like a mad scientist level mushroom cultivator. It's actually a really easy process to keep rebounding and reusing it. But we're not done yet. Now you have spent substrate by the time you're done growing everything out. The mushrooms have broken everything down as they fruited out. Because we're actually eating the fruit. The mycelium is going to be mostly in the substrate. So now we can take that and we can use it for compost or mulch. So we can take spent mushroom spawn straight to the garden, of course. But we don't have to. We can be adding that product to a worm bin, and the worms will further process it, and they will add new bacteria and more beneficial fungi to the entire process before it eventually gets into the garden. Or we take our big compost piles after the thermophilic cycle's over, we take our spent mushroom spawn, and we go ahead and we add that into, and we restart the whole fungal process again. It may not be growing us a bunch of mushrooms we're going to eat. Who knows what we're going to get? But we'll get some of the fungal spores and the mycelium from whatever mushroom, target mushroom we were growing into our compost as well, and thereby increase it further. So now we've put another step. Again, we're back up high in the cycle with it. Who doesn't love mushrooms? Weird people don't love mushrooms. Let's talk about biochar real quick, because that's what inspired this. And I have a chapter, it's probably an hour and a half chapter. It's probably a 45-minute chapter on the high cycle approach with biochar. But what most people think of with biochar is you make the biochar, you inoculate the biochar, you put it in the garden. We want to, again, think as high in the cycle as possible. And biochar gives us an incredible opportunity here. So when we're going to take and make it from prunings and waste and slash and other things that would otherwise simply either be composted or maybe burned past the char stage to ash and just left, you know, as just gotten rid of. But now here's one possible path, because there's many possible paths that I go through in the course. One is you use it to extend your food storage. So if you take biochar, and you're taking like a tray, and you're going to fill that tray, let's say, with apples or potatoes or something like that. They off-gas ethylene, or onions do this too. And that ethylene off-gassing and other off-gassing tends to actually cause the food to decay faster, to start to rot quicker. If it's sitting on biochar, a lot of those volatiles, that biochar adsorbs them. It will actually attract and hold on to them, and that means they're not available to interact with the food, and so your food storage is extended. Now I've done one thing with the biochar that's probably worth having the biochar all in of itself, and that just means that my apples actually make it later into spring and my storage lasts longer because I use the biochar. Yay, I won already. I've already won. I took a waste product and I extended the storage life of my food. But then I can, when I'm done with that, like I can't keep that biochar in there year after year after year. It's done its duty. It's time to put fresh char in when the next food comes in for storage. So I can take that char and it's fairly well charged up, so I can go put it in the garden, but I'm not gonna. No. I'm gonna take that biochar and I'm gonna throw it all into a jar. And I'm going to set it next to my worm bin. And now every time I feed my worms, I'm going to sprinkle a little biochar in there. Now I've got biochar infused with lots of volatiles in it going into the bacteria and fungal beauty that is my worm farm. And the worms will use a little tiny grits of biochar like it is grit in the soil to help, because they have a crop a lot like a bird to help them break things down because they have no teeth. And so that'll go through the worms, and now I've got micro-inoculated biochar in my worm castings just because I used another step in the system. And then I'm going to take the worm castings, as I've said multiple times today, And after this thermophilic cycle in my larger compost, I'm going to put it in there. How many things has the biochar done now? And it's going to end up in my garden or in my forest or whatever, or in my pasture eventually anyway. It's going to end up in the soil. And there's other paths that could go through there. You're doing human manure, the human manure system. You should be using biochar in it, not just stray carbon. It will keep the odor down even more. It will lock the volatiles up. A lot of the things that would off-gas now end up in the final manure compost. Because when we make compost, the reason people say compost doesn't smell when you make it. Anybody that's actually made significant amounts of compost knows that is a lie. That when you first begin the breakdown process, there is a wafting odor of ammonia and other things that come off of it. And then that declines over time. And after about 2 weeks, even though you're far from done, the smell's not there. That's because all the volatiles went up in the atmosphere. Methane, which is fertilizer. You know, nitrogen off-gassing, which is fertilizer. All of these volatiles that off-gas, sulfurs, etc. All these things could be held in the compost and then utilized by the plants for a more nutrient-dense and diverse compost. But you let it get away. But if we have biochar in the compost, we're holding on to that. That's why we put it in the coop, right? So another path would be the biochar gets made, we're putting new material in the deep litter system in the coop. It goes in there and then all the way back through the process, that high cycle approach. Kind of in conclusion here, high cycle thinking multiplies value, reduces waste, builds resilience. That's what this is all about. Building that resilience and that multi-layered system. Again, we can't beat entropy, but we can forestall it. Yeah. What you should ask yourself, how many times can one resource serve you before it's truly spent? Anything in your systems that you look at and go, okay, that's a waste product. That's done. It's done something. Can it do something else before I give up on it? And how little effort can I design into the system to make it do that? You should be, the reason you want to think about this is so you don't end up going, hey, you know what? That stuff could go with that system and be used again. But that stuff and that system are like on complete opposite ends of your property because you weren't thinking about it when you designed those two systems at first. You want to think about and map this out. Draw as many connections as you can so you build systems that are tight, because if it's really easy, if the difference between throwing this thing in the garbage and throwing this thing into a recycle system of some sort, like a composting system, a bokashi bucket, whatever, if the difference is, you know, 10 more minutes of effort to do the good thing, you might not do it all the time. If the difference is negligible, you don't even really notice the difference. I go here instead of here. I'm going to do the thing that I should do all the time because it's easy to do. You know, you want your herb garden close to your house. You want your herb garden close to your house for? Because when it's cold out and you're making stew and you want to go get parsley, but the parsley's way on the other side of the property and it's raining and it's 41 degrees and it's windy, you won't go get it. You won't do it. But if it's right out the front door, I can go out there, chop. Now I got fresh parsley. You got to think like that all the way through your design decisions. Ask yourself again, how many times and how many ways can I use this resource before I let it go? Then the easy layup, look for new layers in your existing systems or additions at the top of your system. So let's talk about biochar again. That's where I kind of really came up with coming at this function stacking with a different approach so that we could come up with more connections. When I started doing biochar and I started listening to all the experts tell me that what I needed to do is make compost tea. And then if I made compost tea, I could put the bucket and put the biochar and dump the compost tea and eventually strain it off and then use the, that's all nice and well, but it also told me I could just mix it in the compost. And they said, if you mix it in the compost that's already made, you need to leave it there for 3 weeks before you apply the compost to let all of the magic happen. the little Barry White music plays and the microbes start reproducing, wah, wah, right? And I'm like, okay, well, that's good. Or I could just put it in the compost. And if I put it in the compost at the beginning, then when the compost was ready, it was done. And then I started researching that, and I learned that if I did that, that it would make the compost better, more completely, and faster. I couldn't find an explanation for that. And after a lot of thought and a lot of research, and I mean, I've gone PhD level research on the biochar like I have on so many other things, I'm convinced this is what's happening. Since the biochar is grabbing all those volatiles and those volatiles stay in the compost, they're there to be part of the process, and therefore the entire process is better, more complete, and faster. But then I said, self, where does all the shit for your compost come from? Most of it comes from the chicken duck coop. What goes in there? Dry carbon. Okay. And what does it smell like in there? Duck shit. I don't like that. So if it holds on to volatiles, why don't you just put the biochar in the coop, because it'll get composted anyway. And so what happened is, instead of I'm going to make biochar and now I have to make compost tea, and then if I don't need compost tea, it's brain dead simple. You make the biochar, you crush the biochar, you store the biochar in 5-gallon buckets, you're adding another layer of carbon, dump a 5-gallon bucket of carbon biochar in the coop, add it. How much work was really added? I had to make the biochar to have the biochar anyway. I had to crush the biochar to have the crushed biochar anyway. Those things were extra steps they had to happen. I have to put the extra carbon in the coop or the coop's going to stink. So we made one little change. Dump the biochar in the coop. That's it. And that put it all the way at the top of the system. And we're doing other things with it. I do feed it to the dogs a couple times a week. I do feed it to the worms all the time. You know, I do sometimes have plenty of biochar around, and I am going to make compost tea because I'm going to spray the plants anyway. So then I'll go ahead and take some of that biochar and inoculate it and put it in the coop or into the garden directly or into my potting mix. But the primary way that the carbon gets cycled from wood slash and trimmings into inoculated biochar, simply throw it in the coop. That's what I want you guys to start thinking about. What can I, when you add a new thing, when you hear something on my show or another podcast or read something somewhere or see something somewhere, and you say, I want to add this, I want this in my life. Do you add it? Is this disconnected element? Or do you say to yourself, self, where can I plug this into the existing system? And is that as high as I can go with it? And if it is as high as I can go with it, as a new waste product stream is created, when it comes out the bottom, can it go somewhere else that's already there or that I can add? You start doing that, you'll just make much tighter designs. With that, before I answer your questions, I want to remind you guys that if you like the type of thing we're talking about here, we do have some really great courses that you can take. And these courses are at homefoodsystems.com. And, you know, I give away pretty much everything that you could ever want from me in my podcast for free. But you can only go so deep at any one time in the way you connect things together. So if you were to take the simplified bioreactor compost, you'll get a lot of what you got today, but a whole lot more and a much better fundamental understanding. Or the principle-based permaculture design course. That's like a 4.5-hour course, and that one's free. And then you have the backyard cover crop and soil secrets course, where we go through these individual topics at a much deeper level, a much more formalized way. There's an exam at the end of every chapter. There's a final exam. There's a certification that comes with it, and they're very, very affordable. The bioreactor compost course, $40. Cover crops course is $80. Principle-based design course, I don't could be more reasonable than free, and MSB members do get a discount. So if you want to really take this to another level and take your design to another level, do consider taking some of the courses there. And, you know, everybody should take the principle-based design course. It's free. And that way you can decide, like, do I really want to actually pay Jack for his courses or not? With that, let's go ahead and take some questions, and then we'll wrap up. Let's go over here to everything I've got starred quite a bit today. Trevor says, how do you feel about the American breast chicken? Okay, I answered Trevor. I think the breast chicken is really fascinating. The people who have done them have told me that the finishing with the milk and the corn and kind of isolating them during that finishing stage, and I don't remember if it's 2 weeks or 3 weeks or whatever, if you really want the highest quality product, the French way of finishing that process is important to actually make the effort of the breasts really worth doing. But most of the people I've talked to that have done them love them. Even the people that don't take that final step when they're doing them for meat seem to like them quite a bit as well. There is a great Telegram group available, the American Breast Chicken Group on Telegram. I actually started that even though I don't have breasts myself. A ton of TS people are in it. You can check that out. Dry River Valley says, what would you recommend as a good way to apply worm casting compost extract on a large scale? Starting a side business where I apply 25 gallons of extract per client, DIY or budget-friendly ideas. So to me, the best thing you could do with that, since you're talking about 25 gallons of extract, is exactly that. You're going to make tea. So I really don't know what you're asking me. If you want to clarify that, if you're still here, you can. But I would look at, like, I have a 35-gallon spray tank. And I just put that on the back of a trailer that I can pull with my lawn tractor, and it runs off a battery. So there's a couple alligator clips, lift up the tractor, and I connect that there. You can build your, you can make your tea rate in it or your extract rate in it, and then you can just drive around and spray. So I don't really know exactly what you're asking me, but that's how I handle that here. Now, I'm not doing it commercially, but again, if you want to clarify that, go ahead. Aaron says, I looked into gray water filtration and reuse, but my county hates gray water reuse. Any status jujitsu for that? Don't tell them you're doing it. I mean, I want you to really think about this. How would they know? How would they know that you're redoing it? My only concern for you would be eventually you're going to sell your home, most likely. When you do that and a home inspector looks at it, they're going to say, wah, wah. So this is what I would do. I would design your gray water system so that you can turn one valve and it goes back to normal. That's what I would do. And then if I was going to do that, I would probably also, if you're going to do like a wicking bed or a reed bed type system with your gray water, which would be the way to maximize it, I would plumb a feed line in so that you could run standard water through that system and irrigate it so that the new homeowner could run it on grid approved. And there's no real harm or foul because once the valves are turned, then it's just an empty pipe. And there's, I don't know of anything that says you can't have an empty pipe in your house or leading out of your house. So that's the way I would do it. Halheem says, idea gray water. How about growing willow, good for tree fodder and artist charcoal? That would be great with the gray water, but you would obviously want the willow growing in the ground on the overflow from like a reed bed or wicking bed system. Because if you grow willow in something like a tank like that, it's going to completely clog the system with massive amounts of roots. Dry River Valley, again, idea, plant small trees and shrubs or other trees around deep bedding crops to allow plants to siphon nutrients from underneath and possibly help retain water. I guess that's in the gray water system as well. Good addition there. Jesse says, add on, direct solar DC pump to recirculate water back to the beginning of the slope from a pond at the bottom. That definitely works. So you could have a system with a small pond at the bottom of it, let's say a 3 or 4 micro swell system with like a small fruit tree system, something more of a zone 2 size food forest or orchard, little garden pond in it. We throw a little pump in the pond and we run up to the top of that system. And this is where having a system that maybe only has enough head pressure to run at the peak and actually get the water there at the peak. So we could vent a little T stroke. So we're aerating the pond whenever the pond's running, but we could tighten that to the point that, let's say, when you have full heavy sun in your summer, which is going to be when you need the most irrigation, that maybe at the highest point for the day, a couple of hours, we're trickling water to the top of the system that matriculates back down to the pond. We're getting aeration and irrigation and nutrient cycling all in one with a zero energy input, very low cost solution. I like it, Jesse. Jesse also says, question, what if you used human urine and poured it directly on the wood chip pile? Is it feasible, efficient? Yes. One of the easiest forms of human waste composting you can do if you don't want to deal with poo is stick to pee. And wood is carbon and urine is mostly nitrogen. And that alone will work. It can be done with wood chips. It can be done with straw. It can be done with any high carbon system. If you allow that system to remain damp, right? You don't want wet, but damp. If you allow that system to remain damp, it will begin to break down almost immediately as you continue to add more of your waste stream to it. If it stays mostly dry and the carbon will absorb it, the water will evaporate and you'll have a dry carbon with nitrogen already there. And the only thing it needs to then break down is to get wet. So it would be just like pulling the straw out of your chicken coop. It's the same scenario. It's actually a very easy way to do things. And it's something that people are a little bit more likely to be willing to do. I have a Rubbermaid tub that I keep a big bucket of wood chips near with a lid on it so they stay dry. And if I'm out and about on the property, I pee in there. I add wood chips to it till it's full. And then it just goes straight into the pit compost over by the duck house eventually. There's a lot of ways to do all of these things. And then we have Jane W. How do I grow mushrooms from coffee grounds? Well, I'm not going to do a whole mushroom episode today, and I am not a mushroom expert. But basically, any substrate you're going to grow mushrooms on, in an ideal situation, you will heat it to boiling. And, of course, the coffee grinds have already had that happen. But between that point and now, probably not. It would be better to do it again. And then you're going to inoculate them with mushroom spawn in whatever vessel you're going to use. Some people would use bags with holes in it for the fruiting. Some would use something more like small buckets or whatever. But you need to research how to grow mushrooms. The coffee grinds are just a different substrate. And for all of the mushroom stuff where everything has to be perfectly immaculate, clean and all, if you're growing something like blue oyster or king oyster, they're very aggressive, heavy growing mushroom, and they're very easy to identify, or king Schrifforia, which are the wine cap mushrooms. You can really just use that material, but you're probably going to suffer yield. But if you don't know what a wine cap mushroom or an oyster mushroom looks like, you probably shouldn't be messing with them. Now, when other things pop up there, unless you really know what you're looking at, be very careful with mushrooms. Some can make you very sick, and some can make you very dead, and some can make you see God climb up a tree and yell at lightning storms, right? So just be careful with mushrooms. But actually, cultivating mushrooms isn't really that hard, especially if it's done indoors. Looks like we got clarification here from Dry River Valley on the extract. I want to apply extract to residential home with a sprayer system. What would your recommended be for starting out? Budget friendly if possible. I still don't know what you're asking me, because you need a sprayer. So either a backpack sprayer or something like the one I described. So if you want to clarify that further, I don't really know where is the holdup, man? Like, what is the budget friendly need that you're not able to meet? Like an Orbit backpack sprayer is less than $100. The 35-gallon tank with electric and all, I think that was, now I bought it years ago at Tractor Supply, but I think it was under $100. So I don't know what you're asking me. I don't get it. I don't understand. Go ahead and clarify if you can, and we'll wrap up. And if you do, I'll be back and we will we'll talk about that right before we end. So real quick, just want to remind you guys that another way you can help support the show, whether you take courses, become members, whatever, is to just do your online shopping at tspaz.com. That's T-S-P-A-Z, tspaz.com. One of the coolest tools that I have found over the years, and it's one of those tools that, like, it's cheap and nothing else does what it does, and so you don't realize how valuable it is until you get one. It's the E-Tech City Laser Rip Digital Laser Temperature Gun. It's basically a thermometer that works with a laser beam. You point it at the surface of something, you pull a trigger, it tells you what the temperature is, either in Celsius or Fahrenheit. These things are extremely accurate. I had a tech here one time working on my AC system. He pulls out his laser temperature gun. It's made by Fluke, who I used to be a regional manager for. And so we started talking about it. And he's I said, let me go get mine. And I showed it. I said, how much does that thing cost? It's like $200. He said, how much is that one in your house? It's like $18. And he's like, yeah, I bet it's not accurate, though. So we pointed at the discharge of the AC, and it's within 1 degree. We went around the house and checked like 10 different things, and it was all within the same or within a degree of each other. So you got an $18 versus $200 tool. And there's a lot of things you can do with these. The write-up on it today is pretty extensive. But, you know, it includes things like knowing that you have the right temperature of a pan when you're cooking something, going out and all this system design we're talking about today, understanding microclimates. Where are your microclimates? Where are your cool spots? You know, sometimes you might have a place that's 5 degrees cooler, 5 feet away from another place, just because there's an undulation in the land and that stays in shade most of the day and the rest of it doesn't. But when you're out there looking at it, it doesn't happen to be at that time. I've had my grandkids run all over the place with this. And it's, again, you won't even know the things that you can come up with in it until you use it. For instance, I have water catchment off my back shop, two 1,500-gallon tanks, so about 3,000 gallons total. How much water is in there? It's a black tank so that it doesn't get skanky. On a day where it's like an odd like temperature differential, you'll see humidity. It shows you a line. But most of the time, especially in summer when you need the water, you don't know how much water is in there. Take this temperature gun, point it at the tank, and start going down the tank with it. When you hit the water line, it'll immediately drop in temperature. That's where the water line is. Lots of cool stuff you can do. They are available today for $18 off Amazon. And no matter what you buy, you can help support the show. Okay. Now I've got driver. He's saying, clarify, does the type of sprayer matter? I've heard some sprayers damage microorganisms. Okay, now we're getting somewhere. You can spend a ton of money to get a sprayer that supposedly doesn't chop up your microorganisms. My experience has been I put extract in my sprayer and I spray it and I get good results. And I wouldn't oversweat this. In the end, you're going to force under pressure something through some sort of spray nozzle anyway. I'm sure you're going to shred some little critters' lives, but I wouldn't worry about it very much. And, you know, we're talking about microorganisms here, really, really tiny. I don't think you lose that much by doing this personally. And if you're going to be doing the volume you're talking of, I would rather spray it than try to put it through some sort of like, you know, 25 gallons of watering cans or something like that. I wouldn't worry about it at all. Okay, now I understand what you were asking. Again, guys, I really appreciate you tuning in today. I'll throw one more little presentation or I guess a little call to action at you. We have now added hats like I'm wearing to the TSP Gear Shop. And one thing I wanted to point out for you guys today about the hats in the Gear Shop is that, you know, if you look at this hat right here, the 1776 hat, for instance, or let's do the one I'm wearing. So you'll notice as I go over it, it changed. So when you go in and you look at the individual hats, there's multiple options available. So this is the black version of the hat. We also make this hat in camo, and then you can decide what type of logo you want on it, and you can see the different options here. So I really like this particular design that I have up, the black and white design. I think it really pops. I also like the one that I'm wearing. today, but there are a whole, so there's only three hats is what it looks like when you get in here. When you start looking at all the different options, and I think our most popular one's going to be the 1776-1984 one there on the left. But of course, we also have shirts and other things like that available at tspswag.com. And so far, the 1776-1984 shirt has been really popular. And there's also options available with each of these as well. They are a little more expensive than the garden variety t-shirts, hats, and things like that. But that's because it's kind of a print-on-demand thing. And the nice thing about that, any size, all these different design permutations, people can pretty much have anything that they want. So again, thanks for tuning in today. Hope you enjoyed today's show. Sorry I stuck you guys with a rewind yesterday. I just ended up way behind the eight ball coming back from that trip and having a little bit of a brain freeze. And I did have an interesting discussion on AI with Tom Woods yesterday. It was about 50 minutes long, that last. And he told me that episode will be coming out on Friday. So if you want to know more about AI, check out Tom Woods' podcast this Friday with yours truly. I'll catch you guys tomorrow. We have a great interview tomorrow, and it will be a Bitcoin breakout episode. Steven Luca from Swan Bitcoin. We had a disconnect the last time I was supposed to interview him. He's confirmed he'll be there tomorrow. We'll be talking about a lot of things happening in the Bitcoin space. And so we're back on the attack. Once again, take care, guys. I'll catch you tomorrow with that episode.
They said you should have a house the American way. Dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.